Welcome to the Injamara podcast. I'm Jack Jacobs.
And I'm Stan Graham.
How are you doing today, Stan?
Good, Jack. We've got a really interesting guest today, Simon Longstaff. I've had a long relationship with Simon, of course, from the Ethics Centre and one of Australia's foremost thinkers and philosophers. We don't have a lot of philosophers in the public space. We have too many journalists.
Are you one of them, Stan?
No, I'm not. I've never really counted myself among the journalists. I see myself more philosophically, poetically, and religiously. I've never been at home in that world. I've lived in it and worked in it, but I gravitate more to the big thinkers. And I don't think journalists are big thinkers, frankly. I think they're the sum of other people's thoughts.
Do you think it's getting hard? Do you think it's getting harder to be a big thinker these days? You know, we hear a lot about the political discourse fracturing, it's getting more extreme, the influx of social media. You know, throughout your career, how difficult has it gotten now to be a big thinker as opposed to, you know, 20, 25 years ago?
Easier in some respects.
Easier,
yeah, right? Because you know, in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed person is king.
Yeah.
And there, you know, to have a little bit of knowledge means you've got twice as much as most people, because we live in an age when people just don't seek it. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who purport to be great thinkers are not. And they write self-help books, self-help philosophy books, self-help political books, self-help theology books, self-help spiritual books. You know, it's cookbooks for thinkers. And and I don't like that. The great thinkers, we don't hear from. We just don't hear from them. The people who are doing the interesting work, the big heavy lifting, we don't hear enough from them. So you'll turn on television, especially, and the public intellectuals will be the people with the biggest voice, the loudest voice, and the biggest microphone. They're not the most interesting people. And Simon's interesting because he's managed to find a space in that public discourse without dumbing down, without abandoning what he is, which is a philosopher. And he sees the world philosophically, and he tries to join the world to those big philosophical questions. I'd be really interested to talk to him today, because he's got a lot of things to say about Australia and what Australia is as a nation. He's also had a unique experience with Aboriginal people, where he's been adopted into an Aboriginal family. And I don't say that lightly. He is a member of an Aboriginal family.
Wow. Yeah.
That is significant. He has responsibilities, reciprocal relationships. He has duties because he is part of a family. And I think as Australia grapples with its history, especially in this year, when we're talking about truth and voice and all of these other things, he is the personification of the space between black and white.
How interesting. Yeah. Well, can't wait to speak to Simon. So let's get on to the conversation.
Simon, Goambana in my language. Welcome, and good to have you with you on the Injamara podcast.
Thanks. I'm really pleased to be able to join you.
I was just saying to Jack, in so many ways, your life mirrors the struggle of this country, and that you find yourself in that sweet spot between black and white Australia and a bridge between those things. And a lot of people may not know this about you, but you are a member of an Aboriginal family. And I wanted to ask you what that means.
Well, it's a really profound thing for me. I struggled with that belonging for years and years, because it was something that came to me when I was very young. I was 17 and I was taken in as a young man in a relatively vulnerable position.
This in the Northern Territory, isn't it?
Yeah, on Groote Island.
Off the Northern Territory, actually. Groote Island,
Yeah, and in the Upper people, and members of the Lalara clan took me in and, you know, kind of gave me my name and totem and all the things that go with that, which I've taken very seriously, even though I've only learned about it slowly compared to anyone on the island would do. So I'm like a toddler compared to the sophistication of their understanding. But the reason I struggle with it is, I mean, anybody who's ever seen me, I've got really fair white skin. and there wouldn't be a single genetic trace, I think. And yet I am as completely accepted as if I'd been born there of local parents.
Wow.
And I remember sitting down with two people, both of them unhappily, who died early, Daisy and Walter Amagula. And I just remember I was in an armchair talking about how hard, you know, my own doubts and things, you know. And they just had one hand on one side of my chest and the other on the other side of my chest. And they said, no, this is really who you are. And, you know, basically our blood's all the same colour and this is a connection that you have. So for me,
can I just come in there and just say to people as well, I've seen this. I've seen Simon's relationship with his family, and I say family, and there is absolutely no distinction between Simon and others.
Yeah.
People, Aboriginal people who call Simon uncle, and it's not just honorific. It's a family relationship. I've seen it, Simon. It is real, and it goes to something that I've seen in my own life. My grandmother is a white Australian, but she was as much a part of our family and our community as anyone, and it is not about blood in that sense. So I just want to push on this a bit and just ask you whether you feel Aboriginal. And I know it's difficult because people don't want to get into appropriating other people's culture and all of those things, but in your relationship with an Aboriginal family in an Aboriginal culture, do you stop being Simon the white Australian?
I do. I relate completely differently, and that means accepting roles, which, like, you know, you suddenly become old man, uncle.
Mm.
You have obligations. Some people say, oh, you get humbugged. Yes, there's a certain we all do. But, you know, you laugh about it.
Humbug's a privilege. Being humbug's
exactly,
a privilege.
Exactly. No, but when you can laugh about it,
yeah,
and when you can say, hey, you know, and they know that it can go both ways, I could humbug someone there too. So, yes, I do become, and of course, I'm always so concerned not to overstep the claim, because I know there'll be people listening, both First Nations and others, who'll say, oh, no, you're having yourself on. And that was the point I made about struggling. I was always very cautious. But you've seen it. Yeah, you've been there with me, with people, and, you know, we are as connected as any. And what that means for me is I just wish every Australian could know that that relationship is open to every single person.
Mm.
And I think part of the problem is so many people who live in Australia, they have never met, or they don't know that they've met a person who's Indigenous. They've never opened themselves to the possibility that they could have that relationship. And so they cannot imagine what I know to be true.
Mm.
And that's, I just wish that people could see, even if I am, and I'm sure I'm not the only example of this, that even if I've got some platform where I can say, actually, this could be for anybody, if only you're open to it.
So, Simon, you know, one of the things Noel Pearson said, I think, in his recent Boyle lectures was that First Nations people are a much unloved people. That was his phrase. And he was using that in the sense of saying that what's difficult about this public debate here and now is that that is getting in the way of the conversations we're having about the voice as a reform piece and the Uluru Statement more broadly. How do you approach that debate, knowing what you do about living between the worlds or within the two worlds, within Black and White Australia?
Well, firstly, it's absolutely true what Noel says about being much unloved, as much as anything, because much unknown. And it's the kind of thing that distinguishes what happened with the debate about same-sex marriage, where everybody had someone in their family who they knew who was, you know, part of the queer community, yet not everybody has someone in their family they know who is Indigenous. And so it's a difficult part of the debate. And I just think that what we have to recognise is that what began with the proposition for, you know, the whole Uluru Statement was not a request to be given something, that it was an offer to become part of something which this thing, just imagine, I mean, when you think about it, think a mob of people have been here for 60,000 years, living, developing, being part of this place, have incredible insights that if only you tap into them and begin to let yourself think about things in a different way, could be there for everybody. And they're saying, oh, yeah, you can be part of this. Now, that's the hands out. And not feel slightly illegitimate because you're on somebody else's country and deep down you know that it was taken. And whereas people are saying, actually, there's a way to everybody to belong to this place, but it means taking the hand that's offered. I just don't think enough people understand that's the generosity of the offer that's there. Because, I mean, if you think about it objectively, over the 230-odd years, if you're on the receiving end of colonisation, about every shitty thing that could possibly happen to you has happened to you or someone. And there's a kind of reason to be angry about that. Yeah. It's not as if anger is misplaced. But then to still be able to make the offer, well, and that's incredibly spectacular.
It's almost, just listening to you speak then, and it's something that's nagged at me as well, is we've got it the wrong way around in a lot of respects. I mean, my father always says, it's not who you are, but where you are. Yeah. You, what you were saying, it's not who you are, Simon, as, let's just use the phrase a white person. I don't even know what that means because it means so many different things. It was where you were. The relationship you had was a relationship to people and place.
Yeah.
Can the Australian Constitution possibly hold that? Or is it the other way around that Australians need to enter into us and the Constitution go out of that? It's almost like we've got it the wrong way around.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thought, Stan. This notion of even when people look at people and country and see them as separate things, that's a mistake, you know.
Yeah.
There is no real distinction. That's why, you know, I try to point out to people when we do a welcome or an acknowledgement of country, the first word you say is, I'd like to acknowledge, well, I'm at the moment on Gadigal country, part of the Eora Nation. And no one stops and says, isn't that a bit odd? You know, we're doing an acknowledgement of country, but we begin with the people. Well, of course you do when you understand that the people and the country are not two separate things. The people don't live on the country, they are of it. There's in it. So there's all sorts of little clues we have around us. And the idea of putting it into the Constitution is a way to try and make sense of what came after colonisation and that world. But I think you're right. If you could actually see it the other way around, you might end up putting it in the Constitution, but for reasons that make much more sense than just because there's a process of a referendum.
So is there a danger then, Simon, because a lot of the leadership around the Yes campaign, for example, phrase this in terms of upholding the Constitution, right? This is about reverence for and respect for the Constitution and making it better than it currently is. I think one of the ways that you have described that before is about completing the work of the Constitution, for example. Is there a danger in that narrative then? Does it locate justice in the wrong place initially by coming to the Constitution before First Nations people, indeed country?
Well, I start off with the brute fact, and it is a fact, that there were a whole lot of people who held sovereignty before the colonisers arrived, and they were completely ignored and left out of all of those discussions about the formation of a new country to be called Australia. While at the same time, the Kiwis were brought in and almost the fans. I mean, you know, the Constitution has got New Zealand in it already recognised. In 1902, when they accorded voting rights to people, the Maoris were given votes, but local mob were not. So, you know, you look at it and you say, how can you, other than prejudice, you know, how can you have ignored what you actually saw staring in your face? That there were people there that had all of the attributes of sovereign states. They had borders, laws, systems of governance and things like that. And you just completely leave them out. So my argument is simply, we've got a constitution which is a bit like a car without a boot or a beer without a head. You know, it works well enough, but it's not finished. The only way you finish it is by recognising what was there, respecting what was there, And you can't rewind the clock completely and say, oh, well, look, everybody nick off and, you know, just leave it and sort of try and arrive again. But what you can do is see the Constitution not as an end in itself, but as a tool towards that particular end.
How do we deal? So, you know, we're not dealing with the moment of founding modern Australia anymore. We're dealing with this, you know, historically down the track. How does that change? Does it change the relationship between First Nations sovereignty and how a First Nations person might feel comfortable being recognised in a constitution they may not feel, you know, can speak to them and their concerns? Does the fact that we're trying to found the nation now on grounds of integrity change the way that this goes down?
Well, it's a bit wonky kind of thing around constitutions, but the fact our constitution, it's a preserver of sovereignty rather than a destroyer of it. So one of the technical aspects about our constitution is that those parties that came into it had their sovereignty completely preserved. So New South Wales, Tassie, places like that, it was left completely intact, fully intact. The only thing that happens under our constitution is that if a valid law of the Commonwealth is enacted, then a state law is inoperative. It's not repealed, it's still there, but it's inoperative to the extent it's inconsistent with that valid law. So if you apply the same general principle, you'd say, well, let's suppose there was some kind of constitutional arrangement around First Nations. All of their sovereignty in relation to the Constitution is still preserved. It's just that some of their laws may become inoperative to the extent that they're inconsistent. And there might be a debate about that, and that's what the voice could do about, you know, is there certain reservations or not? But that's the model. So an Indigenous person from First Nations of Australia, I don't think should be worried about losing something through this process. But my fear is that they won't be given a chance because of the way things are going to even have that debate.
I want to come to your role as a philosopher and look at the importance of words. I mean, philosophy is really about defining concepts, defining our world and exploring the world through those ideas and concepts, testing the limits of those things. But it's a Western epistemology, and it's shaped particularly in a modern sense by what we saw emerging out of the Enlightenment and the separation of God and human beings, and which led to a liberalism, which has defined the terms that set the limits of our political interaction and social interaction in a modern world. I'm just wondering, though, listening to you talk today and thinking about my own experience and the language even that we use, about the clash of these ideas, because in so many ways, the language around this debate can't even begin to touch the sides of my being as an Aboriginal person, as a Wiradjuri person. In the same way, You spoke about the difficulty, Simon, in coming to terms with that incredible duty, honour, responsibility that was bestowed on you by those people. When we use language like constitution, even when we use language like sovereignty is a political, Western, Westphalian concept that defines nation states or defines law. These things can't begin to touch the sides of who we are as Aboriginal people. And there's an existential tension, isn't there, between us as people in an unbroken, continuous connection to place and culture and a modernity that doesn't even have the language to speak to that, and yet we have to find a place in it. Mm. As a philosopher, how do you approach that?
Mm.
Well, the first thing I'd say is that the correct description you've given of the current problem, which I'll come back to, is not itself a function of philosophy per se. It is a function of a particular mode of philosophical engagement, but there are other ways of doing philosophy,
right,
throughout the sweep of human history across all cultures. So it's not just it's not only people in the West who do philosophy. There are lots of people who thought about the world. And not all of the directions of philosophy necessarily lead to this abstraction away from embodied experience and tradition and things of that kind.
Which the Enlightenment does. But the Enlightenment looms so much over our world, doesn't it?
Well, what it does is because, and it goes with the scientific revolution and the notion of objectivity and subjectivity, none of that makes sense if you live within what I have experienced. I'll talk only about what I know from my bit of experience, that particular worldview that's alive on group. There is no separation between the human individual and the totality of existence. There is no simple logic of cause and effect between material events, causes and material effects. There are a whole lot of symbolic and what I would call broadly spiritual connections in which you are enmeshed, and everything is enmeshed, not just the usual divisions between things which are apparently animate and those are inanimate. Well, there's two moieties, Yurichur Dua, white cockatoo, black cockatoo, everything is in it, and that includes things which other people with a lesser sensibility might just see as a rock or something like that. And so it's not actually, it's more than that. It's invested with a whole significance. It literally is invested with a presence. And so that way of living in the world, that holistic belonging where you are part of a much wider web, you'll find it in philosophy at different times, but it's not easily accommodated by the Enlightenment worldview, at least as it's expressed in its analytical forms and scientific method and a whole lot of things. And so that's why when we have these conversations, we talk about constitution and sovereignty, it doesn't begin to touch the surface of what people experience and what they're offering. It's almost like people saying, here's something, people cannot see what it is because we're set up not to see it unless you are inducted into this.
And you hit on the key word, Simon, and that is spiritual. And as someone who's explored philosophy, I mean, my struggle in the world, if you like, has been how do I locate my dreaming in the Enlightenment that I am born into as part of a Western world, as part of modernity? How do I do that? And the struggle has taken me to the water's edge, but it doesn't get me in the water. The Enlightenment doesn't get me in the water. And you mentioned the word spirituality, and this is, again, in an age where, as Nietzsche said, God is dead, or the idea of God is dead, but it's not dead for us. And you've seen that in your own experience. We don't ask, does God exist? That would be absurd from our standpoint and our spirituality. When I stand on my country, the relationship between Bayami, as we call the creator God, myself and my country, is indivisible. There is not a slither of light between it. So the spiritual rubs up against modernity, the Nietzschean God is dead idea of modernity. And how is philosophy enough to get us into the water where spirituality is found?
I think it helps. So let me give an example. I don't know what you'll think about this, but I actually think that it's possible to hold multiple levels of meaning concurrently.
Right.
So I might see a sunrise and see that I can describe it, for example, in terms of physics, you know, about the refraction of the light and the angles and things like that. I can also ascribe it a spiritual significance, and I can turn it into poetry. And I can do this all at the same time. And I think a lot of First Nations people do exactly that. So it's not as if the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders of this place didn't have a fantastic understanding of the medicinal properties of plants. When other people were busy inventing the wheel, they invented the wing, you know, which is a pretty spectacular technical innovation, as you can see reflected in a thing like a boomerang. I mean, so who got the better bit of technique, the wheel or the wing? Well, the wing is a pretty spectacular thing. And yet they also would have been able to take this and have it in an artistic form, which then integrated with dreaming and other things. So now that's the kind of thing a philosopher might draw attention to and say, have you thought about the connection of these things? And are they therefore, what do we make of that? And how is it that we can do all of those things at the same time? And so maybe what philosophy does is it both creates the problem, but it might also provide a way of at least identifying it so we can start to talk about it and say, okay, maybe we don't need to sort of squish them into one thing.
Because one of the things I'm really struggling with, Simon, for example, I've been educated in a kind of, you know, Western philosophical background, and there's this challenge of trying to make ideas from Western philosophy reconcile or work alongside indigenous ways of knowing and thinking and being. Do we end up with what Berlin thought of as a tragedy, where they're irreconcilable, the two ways of seeing the world? Or can they exist, as you have just said, as sort of patterns of meaning that are linked?
Or don't have to be reconciled. That's the other possibility, that you don't need to be. So, for example, we three are probably simultaneously, at least Stan and I, we're fathers, we're sons, we're lovers and husbands, we've got kinship obligations. It's just the same bloke in each case that's there, but we are all of these things at one time, and they're subtly different. They may be connected, but they are subtly different. And so perhaps there's a multiplicity of ways of knowing and being that don't have to be ultimately resolved into something that's just, but you do. Now I'm not saying that's the answer, I'm just thinking about that. The other thing I would say is, although there may seem to be a radically incommensurate connection between certain cultures, worldviews, there is a deep structure which is universal, and it's universal within all times and all places. And that deep structure goes to the role inevitably human beings are driven to make choices where they do have a choice, so I'm not talking about the demands of necessity here, by values and principles. The values and principles will change from place to place and time to time, but there will always be that basic structure which is shaping the choices that are being made in the world that emerges from it. And that means there's points of contact that you can begin to explore.
That's happening.
Yeah, so Simon, one of the things I want to explore with you as well is the idea about our public debate. I mean, the way we're talking today, and, you know, this is for a particular audience and we can have this conversation, but how do you as a philosopher bring these things to the public space? Well, I'm wondering if we even have the literacy to be able to engage in the level of debate and conversation that we need to spiritually, philosophically, and politically. How do you bring that to the public domain?
Well, for me, one of the really important lessons I've learned in my life is that it's a terrible mistake to underestimate the capacity of people of very diverse backgrounds to have these conversations. It's about the skill of the communicator, and Stan, you're brilliant at this. Jack, you probably are too, I just don't know you well enough to say it. But
the skill of taking time.
What is apparently impenetrable and complex, and to make it accessible. And one of my great criticisms of modern philosophy in particular is that instead of it dedicating itself to clarity and to accessibility, it's almost like a priestly class emerged who used obscure language and impenetrability to give them a special status. And I think the best philosophers who've ever lived are those who take what are really complex ideas and make them so that anybody can engage with it, which is not to embrace a false kind of simplicity that makes things purely simplistic. You can have all the complexity still there, but you make it so people can engage. And I think, yeah, that's partly about increasing the literacy of the public. Yeah, you want people to be able to understand broad things. But I think it's also about skilling up philosophers, public intellectuals and others to present things in a way which relate to anybody, and then take them seriously. Don't talk down. You actually find out, actually, you sit in a truck or on the side of a road, you can be out in the community, you can be in a boardroom, you can be down in Canberra, And there are ways that you can speak with people where everybody can be involved and understand. And you'll often learn a hell of a lot more by doing that than you would by sitting ensconced in your own private languages and things like that.
Simon, this is a moment that's really morally crucial for Australia. You know, we're considering the voice in the Uluru Statement. What's the role of the public intellectual at this moment? Is it to take an advocacy position in the debate, i.e. to advocate for a yes or no pathway? Or is it instead to play an independent role to challenge, inform and critique?
I think there's a legitimate role for both sorts of things. For me, I would see my role principally being to aid informed decision making, and that in part means exploding myths that are being advanced. There are bad arguments and there are good arguments, and people will often try to manipulate public opinion by putting forward false claims, bad arguments and all the rest. And I think it's a legitimate thing to do in the service of truth and informed decision making to point out those things and then ensure that people have the best possible opportunity to reach an informed decision for themselves. I think that is often the most constructive thing, because it honours the ability of the person to make their own mind up, to it takes them seriously. But it says, look, in this debate, not anything goes. If you don't remain neutral, you become positively oriented towards truth and principle.
Dr. Simon Longstaff, for our listeners, is the Executive Director of the Ethics Centre. He's a subtle and principled thinker between worlds.